This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
We'll do Twilight, New Moon, which is the second one there. We've got Serious Man.
I'd like to get to Serious Man, which you've also seen. It's a week in which you've seen everything that I've seen.
Well, it's a Coen Brothers film.
Yep.
And The Informant, which is the new Matt Damon film.
Yep.
So let's do the box office top 10. We'll do this before 3:30.
Okay, so I shall be brief.
No, you won't, because there's lots of 2012 and a lot of people really, really going to take you to task.
I know.
If there's a movie that you haven't seen. At 10.
Including Jason Isaacs.
Jennifer's Body at 10.
Which I like. You know, I think that it's a well-written piece and it's made by somebody who actually likes horror films. And I'm surprised it hasn't done perhaps slightly better.
An Education at number 9.
No, still not
what?
There. Still not there. No,
what?
Because it's been so much
what?
To keep up with.
So many people are saying, has the Good Doctor seen
no, I
Education
no.
yet?
No, and I do really want to. I do really want to, and I am really going to. And if I'm going to have to, because award season's coming up, and it's, you know, everyone's tipping it
for... How many weeks do you need? I mean, it's at number
You know
nine.
What I would
it's
like? If there was a week when there wasn't 9 movies out, then it would be possible to do.
Oh, well, let's just reduce the output. But here is a movie...
Yeah, that would be a good thing.
Nick Bailey, Dr. Nick Bailey, Master in Aerospace Engineering, Grade C in GCSE French. Dear Innie and Outie, I hope by this week that the Good Doctor will have found time to see an Education and be ready with a review. I took my girlfriend and friends last Sunday to our local picture house. On your prospective recommendation, overall we enjoyed it. A pleasing number of titters and laughs with some enjoyed awkward family moments. The seductive yet creepy Peter Sarsgaard, don't get in the car.
With Ed Balls.
It's Ed Balls. Run away.
I mean, I haven't even seen the film, and that's all I know about it. It's that she gets in a car with Ed Balls.
The fantastic Kerry Mulligan. I mentioned this is an interesting point Nick puts at the end. Sadly, one friend who is studying for her PhD in Jewish art was shocked and distraught by the derogatory, stereotype-laden portrayal of David as Jewish. The rest of us, however, didn't pick up on this. Perhaps we are unfamiliar with the stereotypes. Does the film have an anti-Semitic sentiment, or is it simply a comment on 60s Britain?
Simon?
I certainly didn't pick up on it.
But then you're thick.
But if also, I'm not studying Jewish art, so maybe those people who are studying it will have picked up on that. But given that you haven't actually been bothered to see the movie at all,
I wouldn't know.
You know, you can't comment. But this time next week, you will have seen it.
Fine.
Fourth Kind, is it 8?
Fourth Kind. Where is the... the Fourth... Sorry, I was blanking for that. Fourth Kind is the thing which is allegedly based on a true story and clearly isn't, and features footage which is allegedly real-life footage but clearly isn't, and is total nonsense and rubbish.
Michael Jackson's This Is It at 7?
You know, not a film, but as I've said before, if there was footage of Elvis performing like that just before he failed to do the tour, that he died before, so he didn't do it, then I would want to go and see it. And I am warming slightly to the idea that anything that brings people into the cinema, that keeps the cinemas able to function, is actually not a bad thing. So I'm actually more positive about it than I thought I was going to be.
And Fantastic Mr. Fox at 5, The Man Who Stared at Goats at 5.
Which I like. They can't both be at 5.
No, so Fox is at 6, Goats at 5.
At 5, which
up
I like.
At 4, going down.
Yes, and interestingly enough, the debate about up 3D, up 2D continues.
Yes,
and
but not now.
Okay, can I just say 30% colour loss in 3D?
Thank you. Harry Brown's at 3. Malcolm Hepperlett from Reading. Mark, you missed the point about Harry Brown.
Okay.
I saw it last night. Whilst it was a very uncomfortable film to watch, it was brilliantly filmed and I couldn't take my eyes off the screen from beginning to end.
It is very well made.
From my point of view, the film was simply an observation of a particular subculture rather than of a piece, as you said last week. I don't think the director was trying to say that vigilantism is morally acceptable in any way or that it is right or wrong, just that this kind of thing could happen and this is how it could take place, and maybe if we aren't careful, given the circumstances, a person could be driven to this kind of action. As for Michael Caine, you said it's hard to take against him. Well, why would you want to take against him? The man is a legend and this is one of his best performances to date. Okay, he's been in some bad films, but you've given some shocking reviews and I still listen to you. Pan's Labyrinth springs to mind, says Malcolm, a good film, but please. The point is that Harry Brown is an extremely well-made film and we should do well to learn from its message that disenfranchisement has consequences.
Can I say two things? The first one is that a director does not have to believe in a philosophy for his film to reflect it. Michael Winner, for example, has made movies which have very, very clear political philosophies which he totally disavows, and that's perfectly fine. You trust the tale, not the teller. Secondly, the way in which the movie works is to set up a dynamic which dramatically, when you're watching it, is these hoodies are completely out of control, and what's happening with the Michael Caine character doesn't actually actually end up having a negative repercussion upon him, which is the traditional way these dramas would play out, is that somehow it damages the it's the idea that violence begets violence and violence brings us all down. I do think that the film has an ethos which is terribly troubling. It doesn't matter whether the filmmakers think it does. It does. As I said before, they just made the film. I saw it.
We've got Disney's Christmas Carol at 2.
Yes, a Christmas Carol in 3D.
With Jim Carrey.
Yeah, with Jim Carrey
doing
lots of...
Just go see him up at Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the great, you know, the Michael Caine role as well. It's fantastic, so, you know, brilliant.
2012 is at number one. Tim in Nottingham. Dear Boromir and Faramir. So let's tally. Roland Emmerich has given us a giant lizard attack in New York, an alien invasion of Earth, a vision of cataclysmic climate change, a glimpse of life in 10,000 years BC, complete... with giant emus.
That's
and
right.
Now
yeah,
a depiction of the end
that.
Of the world.
Yeah.
The Middle East is left unscathed by this disaster because, in Emmerich's own words, I didn't want to become another Salman Rushdie. Incidentally, Emmerich has said 2012 is his last disaster movie, so perhaps now he'll start making proper films. Stephen Leicestershire, dear Pop and Tart, saw 2012 in Milton Keynes on Friday night. It's possibly the most laughably stupid film ever. They gave us a survey after the film finished and asked, why did you come and see this film? They had to get their audience figured out when one of the suggested answers was, because I like to see other countries being destroyed. which I quite like. Simon Wilder says, dear Simon and Schuster, I am more than pleased to have seen 2012, which is no more than 158 minutes too long, if only to be reminded that there is no event too urgent or too catastrophic to get in the way of saying I love you.
It is incredibly boring. Jason Isaac sent me an email saying, look, if you look up 2012...
Is this a private email, by the way?
Well, it's an email to me.
Might that be a private piece of correspondence?
But I don't know. You were around with him the other night,
yes,
having
correct.
Some friendly occasion that I didn't know anything about.
That's right.
He's my friend, and now you steal him away. Now I don't have any. How does that work? That's you weren't funny. At school with him.
No.
How come you're allowed to hang out with him?
He's
anyway,
so moved on.
Fine, yeah. His email said, you know, if you go on the internet...
And
hello, Jason Isaacs. If you go on the internet and you Google 2012, there's loads and loads of stuff, but every 2012... You know, so he says, your theory about the accountants is nonsense.
It is rubbish. Genuine. It's clearly... The film has been thought of for a very, very long time, so your accountants...
By
theory,
accountants.
Yeah.
It's been thought of for a very long time by accountants. That's point number one.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
the whole point, the maths of it don't work.
No, 2012, of course they do. You release it. We did it before. You release it now, then you release the video,
anyway,
then you release
this.
But, but last point, the one thing I want to concede.
Very quickly.
Somebody sent in a comment which said, Kermode says, if you do CGI, you can do anything, right? And he said, well, frankly, I'd like to see you do it. And you know what? That was a good point. Actually, the one thing I take back is, it is true. If you do CGI, you can't do anything. It takes greatly skilled CGI artists to do that stuff. It doesn't have the same thrill for me as watching the car flip over in The Man with the Golden Gun, but it does, and I stand duly corrected on that point.
Okay, New Moon coming up next. It's the second in the Twilight franchise.
Trigger.
To be discussed in a moment, three movies which we will guarantee to review before 4 o'clock. A Serious Man, new from the Coen brothers. The Informer, which is the new Matt Damon movie. And the Twilight saga continues. New Moon is out. Take it away, Dr. K.
So, the story so far, as you know, is that Bella has fallen in love with Edward, but the nature of their love is such that it cannot be consummated because he is terrified that he will bite her and turn her into a vampire. So at the beginning of the movie, she is 18th birthday is around. He decides, crucially, at an early point, that in fact he is going to have to go away. He is going to have to abandon her for her own good. And yet it seems like...
We kind of know that. We kind of figure that bit out, but she doesn't realise that.
No, which is amazing because kind of everybody else does. So he goes away. She then finds that the depression into it... And boy, I have to say, she does sulk. Man alive, if you want sulky, there we are.
She's through the film.
She is Mrs. Sulky, Sulky, Sulky. Anyway, so she is sulking. Luckily for her... There is the old childhood friend who used to be a young boy, has now grown up into the most spectacularly buff young man, who runs around in a pair of sort of cut-off shorts with no top on.
The way you do.
The way you do, with four or five other guys who run around in a pair of cut-off shorts with no top on, all of whom have got, you know, total cracking six-packs and look like they... I mean,
haven't we all?
Yes. And, I mean, they... It is true that there may be a Hulk-like reason for the fact that they're running around in uh-huh. just the shorts. Anyway, here is a clip of the new potential. So obviously, the young man Jacob would like to be Bella's boyfriend, but as with all these characters, he has a dark secret. Here it is.
What did you do? Hey, what did you do to him?
Watch it, little girl.
He didn't want this.
What did we do? What did he do? What did he tell you?
Both of you, calm down.
Nothing. He tells me nothing because he's scared of you.
Paul, don't.
Too late now.
Bella, get back. Paul. Paul, get back now.
Bella!
Run!
Not going to start doing
No, I'm not. But okay, fine. I'm sorry. And incidentally, that's pretty much the best audio clip that there is available, despite the fact that it has basically a lot of roaring. Now, look, Cards on the Table time. As you know, I was a big fan of the original Twilight. And I am, I have to say, rather fond of the whole idea of Twilight. There's been a lot of stuff in the press recently saying, oh, you know, it's dragging on, it's becoming boring, and, you know, the first one was okay. Well, actually, I don't remember a lot of people saying the first one was okay at the time. I mean, the audiences absolutely loved it, but it did get a lot of critical derision at the time. So I went in with high expectations. The first thing to say is that because of the nature of the story, at the very, very beginning, Edward goes away, right? He goes away, and there is some sulking to be done. So consequently, there is, from the sulking, a certain languorous quality to the first movement of Twilight, which is, come on, you know, there is there's sulking and there's really sulking and there's, blimey, Charlie, how much longer are you going to sulk? So that's fine. So there is a bit at the beginning of it, which you started, and I actually thought very early on, about 25 minutes, and I thought, oh, they've dropped the ball and this isn't going to work and it's going to be a problem. It's kind of lost the perfect simplicity of the original, which it was so great in the way the dynamics worked out. I mean, it's a simple idea. I mean, I know everyone talks about the fact that it's, you know, it's an abstinence tale, but in fact so much of this fiction anyway is about exactly that. The whole, you know, vampire mythology is completely steeped in the idea of abstinence and restraint as opposed to indulgence. It's the, you know, it's the damned if you do, damned if you don't. That's the whole point of the tragic romantic love. There are at the
beginning. It's quite easy to be abstemious if the person that you're friendly with might bite your head off.
No, but exactly. But yes, but of course, you know, you don't have to be a sociology lecturer to say, okay, well, fine. Well, what that therefore is about is the underlying idea is that the boys in her life all become dangerous at the point that they become, you know, young men, and therefore there is, and actually the good young men are the men who are able to rein in their dangerous side for all the right reasons. So obviously, I know, you know, this is writ large, people talk about it as an abstinence thing, perfectly fine, I have no problem with that whatsoever. I actually think that just to say it's about abstinence is to somewhat undervalue what it's actually about, because there's a Romeo and Juliet motif running all the way through it. There's a great discussion about Romeo and Juliet and whether you would die for love and whether, you know, whether you would give up your life for, you know, for something else. And of course, the whole dynamic of it is whether or not Bella will give up her soul in order to be with Edward, because an idea which has been explored in all vampire fiction, I mean, I suppose most recently something like The Hunger, the idea is if you're in love with a vampire, you will soon become older than the vampire. There's a lovely moment where she says, I'm older than you. He says, no, I'm 156. And she says, yes, but I've just turned 18 because
he's 107,
actually. 107, sorry, fine. So he is, I'm very glad that you're clearly so on with the details.
On the focus there.
And I love that idea. I love that sense of somebody at the age of 18 suddenly panicking that they're actually that they are growing away. And I find that, I mean, in the end, I think that so much of what vampirism and zombie myths are all about is to do with the mortality of the flesh, the fact that everything ages and withers and dies, and the great charm of the vampire is that it doesn't age, but the deal therefore is if you don't age you lose your soul, and consequently that's it, that is the entire mechanism of the story, is what is more important, the fact that you are going to outgrow this person and the fact that you are going to age and die but with your soul, or that you're just going to embrace them. And you know that in the way of all teenage love stories is the answer is the second one. I will do anything, it doesn't matter what it is, I will do anything because we are in love together. And of course Edward, who is the enigmatic charismatic character in all this, is
played
by Robert Pattinson, has to say no, I'm not going to do it. Now, after that initial dip, when I thought this is actually going to be 2 hours of mopey, I thought it found its feet again. Now, there are things about it that are slightly smirk-inducing in a way that they weren't in the original. I mean, the sight of the buff young guys running through the forest, being incredibly buff with their tops off, it did raise a titter, because it's just like, fine, it's okay, I understand entirely, you know what your target audience is, and there's nothing wrong with a bit of beefcake or cheesecake. Remember the long discussion we had about which of those is the correct... No, that's fine, great. How nice, for once, that a teenage movie is getting the boys to do the running round, you know, showing their tops off.
There's a bit where Bella bangs her head on a rock. Little cut of about an inch, I would say.
Tiny.
In length. To which your man then takes his entire T-shirt off.
He does. He's into what? As opposed to taking a bit of his T-shirt off.
Yeah, that's right. Or just taking a hanky out of his pocket.
Yeah, no, at any given moment...
And dabs her head with it.
If you look like that, wouldn't you take... If we look like that, we would present this show in Speedos, frankly. So I don't have any problem with that at all. And by the time we got into the final movement of the film... There is this kind of... There is a somewhat contrived, somewhat Love Actually... Okay, rather than we've got to go to the airport, we've got to go to Rome. And then there's an incredibly camp performance by Michael Sheen, who was on the show the other day, who turns up in...
Top performance.
It's camp as nuts. I have nothing against it being camp as nuts, but it is incredibly camp. He's got the sort of the hair extension. And
I'm nuts camp. Can you be camp as nuts?
I think you can be anything as nuts. And he is playing this very sort of sinister, high vampire character.
King of the Vampires.
Yeah. Michael Sheen is, in fact, king. Michael Sheen is king of everything that he surveys. But it is a funny turn. I mean, I think it's knowingly funny. I think it's because it's so arch. It's so kind of... Actually, funnily enough, there are hints in it of Bill Nighy, because there are moments which he curls his lip and stands in a certain way.
And didn't you think there were a couple... I mentioned it to Michael yesterday. There's a moment where he smiles and I think, oh, that's Tony Blair.
Yes, but that's absolutely right, because the character is a diplomatic character who is also deeply dangerous and untrustworthy. So that does work. So
hello
Michael Sheen. Hello to David Morrissey. Hello to Fairport Convention. Hello to Jason Isaacs. We did him already. But so in general, despite the saggy, sulky, moany beginning, I actually thought it found its footing again. And by the time we got to the end, and it ends on a little bit of a romantic cliffhanger. Yes. Don't frown.
No, it's one of those. Oh, don't leave it there.
No, that was great. That's what I. By the time we got to the end,
you can't leave Bulldog Basil there.
Yes. By the time we got to the end, I was going right. Sign me up for the third instalment. Yes. So I have to say, I'm a sucker for it. Despite the things that I think are wrong with this one, I am a sucker for it. I did enjoy it.
There is a moment.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the moment, you should stand up and shout something. I haven't quite worked out what you have to shout. And that is the most gratuitous piece of product placement since James Bond discussed
this
watch.
Oh, yeah.
Where an aeroplane flies from one side of the screen to the other for no apparent reason, and with a nice big close-up.
Yes, I know.
Which Richard Branson will go, oh, that's my...
But then, of course, there is a sort... There is a thematic gag in that.
Can we...
The audience could put it this way. If it says British Airways, there isn't a thematic gag, right? If it says EasyJet... Actually, EasyJet would have been an ironic thematic gag.
Simon, I'm on my way to the cinema to see New Moon. It's good. My first trip to the cinema for years. I'm so excited about it. Love Twilight and the books. Don't let Mark diss it.
No, I'm not dissing it. I'm not. We're on side with Twilight.
Phyllida Jones, Simon, my daughter has been invited to a screening of New Moon today, Friday. Listening to your programme, I'm getting more and more concerned about letting her go. This came in yesterday. Oh. She is 11 years old. She doesn't like being scared. We watched Doctor Who last weekend. That was okay for her, but she wouldn't have wanted any more scary stuff than that. Could you ask... Oh, this is actually for Michael Sheen, so I'll just interpret it for you. Can you ask Mark whether or not he thinks it's suitable for her to see? Well, if she liked Twilight, she'll be fine.
It's certainly no more scary than Twilight.
Yeah.
Incidentally, can I just say one other word of criticism? I thought some of the Vulpine CGI was a little bit wobbly.
Consider it done. The Vulpine is the king of aristocracy.
Trying not to give that away. No, I don't mean Vulpine. No. I'm trying not to give it away, I think everybody knows what it is.
I was getting them confused with the
Wobbly dogs.
The Volturi.
Wobbly dogs.
Very interesting that Michael Sheen should have... he's now played a werewolf and a vampire.
He has.
Is that unique? No, it can't be.
No, but he is game for anything. And of course, in the other ones, which I can't remember the names of now, in which he does do the running around in the leather trousers with the shirt off.
The Underworld.
He looks pretty fit as well.
Philip Jones, dear Culture Show and Season Pro, I'm one of millions of Twiglet widowers and have been forced to watch the first film and now probably the second two. Does the good doctor agree that the theme of the books and films is about chastity?
Mm-hmm.
The whole Edward, I want you to bite me, but I can't thing. It's very Bible Belt America, Jonas Brothers kind of thing. I think mind control for tweenies. I think people have misunderstood this.
Yeah, I think so. Well, so fine. So you think what? You agree with me?
I entirely agree with you. There is not one word of what you say which I disagree with.
Really?
I think they're great. And I think people who just think it's just mind control between us, they've kind of not quite got it.
No, they have kind of not quite got it. And they haven't got the whole kind of, you know, doomed emo goth romance part of it, which is very important. Serious Man, the new movie by the Coen brothers. When we talked about this on the Culture Show London Film Festival special, and you asked me what I thought, I said I thought it was, you know, it's a very interesting widget of a film. You said, what do you mean widget? I said, well, it's a strange... you know, odd little film. And it's like after they'd done No Country for Old Men, which of course, you know, was a great big Oscar winner, and then they made Burn After Reading, which was a sort of, you know, a celebrity guest list movie which had done really well. It sort of felt to me like the Coens had decided they wanted to make a film for themselves. They wanted, now I think that almost everything they do in the end is for themselves. I can't ever imagine the Coen brothers sitting down and, you know, getting a preview audience in going, well, what do you think? Should we change it to make it more acceptable? You want that guy to be a different person? They think in the end they are their own test audience. And sometimes that matches up with popular taste and sometimes it doesn't. When I saw Serious Man, I liked it very much, but I also thought it's a movie with a small audience. In fact, I had spoken to one of the people who produced it who had said specifically that they knew that it was a movie with a smaller audience. It doesn't have name stars, for example. I mean, the lead actor is a very, very well-known theatre player, but not a movie star. So they'd had to scale the budget down. They knew, essentially, they weren't able to spend a huge amount of money on it. Now, when you did your interview with the Coens, they did mention this. You said, are you able, as the Coen brothers, to do whatever you want?
They said, it was a few weeks ago, but...
Oh, was it?
Yes. It might have felt like yesterday, but actually it was a few weeks ago.
Everything you do seems so timeless, to put it in a thing. And they said, well, we can do whatever we want within financial constraints. So they, you know, reined the finances in. Anyway, so the story is, well, there's a strange little prologue, which we'll come back to. The story is essentially in the 60s, but not the swinging 60s. Out in the remote area of the Coens' childhood, our hero or anti-hero is a man to whom bad things start to happen for apparently no reason. His refrain all the way through is, I haven't done anything. You know, why is this all happening to me? His marriage falls apart. His job starts to fall apart. He starts to get threatening messages. He seems to be getting sent stuff in the mail that he hasn't asked for. It seems as if the whole world is conspiring against him. And two things happen. One of them is that he starts to wonder whether or not this is somehow related to some sense of cosmic fate, to religion, to God, to some sort of retribution. And the second is that everyone around him starts to wonder whether or not he genuinely is a man of any substance or indeed a serious man. Here's a clip.
You know, Larry, the way we handle ourselves in this situation... so important.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Judith told me that she broke the news to you, and she said that you were very adult.
Did she?
Absolutely. The respect she has for you.
Yes?
Do you drink wine? Because this is an incredible bottle. This is not Morgan David, Larry. This is a wine. A Bordeaux.
You know, sir.
Open it. Let it breathe 10 minutes. Letting it breathe. So important.
Thanks, Si, but I'm...
Listen,
I'm not...
I insist, Larry. There's no cause for discomfort. I'd be uncomfortable if you didn't take it.
Mm.
Larry, listen. These are signs, tokens, Larry.
I'm not ungrateful. I just don't know a lot about wine, and given our respective...
It's okay. Larry, we're going to be fine.
It doesn't make you want to scream, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's such a terrific performance. That
is the man who has just taken his wife.
Yes, Fred Melamed playing Sly Abelman, who has taken his wife out from under, but it's okay, you know. It's everything. I can't even attempt to do him. And there are moments like that in the film, which are just so terrifically painful. You know, people talk about The Office as being painful comedy. This has a similar level of pain, but without the sort of without the lack of artifice. I mean, this is very, very heavily mounted. It's clearly a, you know, dramatic production, but it has that same level of awkwardness and unease. Now, essentially, the narrative trajectory is that bad things happen, and bad things happen, and bad things happen, and he doesn't know why these bad things are happening, but he sort of suffers them in that terribly sort of deadpan, you know, flat way of not erupting, not doing it. Some people have said that, in fact, his character is a stand-in for Job. You know, it's Patience of Job
Book
thing.
Of Job, yeah.
But, of course, the Coens themselves, when they were speaking to you just yesterday, I believe it was, Simon, said that it's not to do with him having... It's not to do with the film being a test of his faith. It's a test of his complacency. It's about somebody who's not doing anything suddenly facing a world in which the world is doing stuff to him. And, you know, the thing it reminded me of, very oddly, is, you remember Clerks, the Kevin Smith film? Mm-hmm. The refrain in Clerks is, I'm not even supposed to be here. And I know they're two completely different films, but there is that same sense of, I'm not even supposed to be. How did this happen? Why me? Why me? Why has all this happened to me? Now, the whole thing is then framed within this sort of quasi-mythological universe by the fact that at the beginning there is an apparently unconnected and borderline supernatural event which sort of seems to set in place a curse. And what you get the sense of is what you're watching may be an ancient curse playing out in modern times. But it's such a peculiar film. And the thing that I want to be completely honest about is when I saw it, I sat there and I saw it completely on my own. I thought, I really like it. I think these performances are great. This is so kind. Like, they've made this for themselves. And you know what? This film is going to be enjoyed by four people. It's got 5-star reviews everywhere and everyone loves it. And the thing that I didn't see coming at all was just how much everyone... Now, I don't think it's going to be a huge mainstream hit. But in the same way as when I saw No Country for Old Men, I thought that's very, very faithful to the Cormac McCarthy novel there. You know, it's fine. It's a Coen Brothers film. It looks like this might actually be a hit. And I am genuinely surprised.
Just quickly, one thing to point out.
Yes.
Before our final couple of minutes, Vulpine is resembling a fox.
Oh, I say fox. Okay.
Lupine.
What did I say? Vulpine.
Vulpine. I beg your pardon. Resembling a wolf.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy Serious Men?
I did, although I found him fantastically irritating. Just stand up for something. Let something good happen to this, you know, and so...
No, but that's the whole point. The whole point is... It's the thing about the man who does nothing.
Useless.
Yeah, he's
utterly useless.
He's useless, and consequently, it's the being the person who does nothing and saying, I don't do anything.
Matt Damon has a film out.
Matt Damon! Although that's completely unfair. It's the new Steven Soderbergh film, and it is, in inverted commas, a true story of somebody within an industry who decides to blow the whistle on the industry, gets in the federal authorities to hear his side of the story. But as his side of the story unravels, it appears that less and less of what he says is actually true. I don't think we have time to play a clip of this. So here's what needs to be said about it. Did you see that film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind?
Yes.
Okay.
Russell Crowe.
No, that's Dangerous Minds.
Dangerous Minds. Now, that could confuse us.
Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which is I think, a really, really terrific piece of work with Sam Rockwell, okay?
Okay.
And I'll probably turn out that's actually not called... No, it is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Anyway, the point about it is...
One minute left.
What's exciting about that film was it was taking somebody who was an unreliable narrator, seeing the world from their point of view, and making a fantastic drama out of the hooey and the baloney and the flim-flam and all the stuff that they kind of conjure from their mind. It becomes a very, very intriguing drama. The Informant attempts to do that, and I have to say fails. It's a Soderbergh film, and it is certainly one of his, you know, not more significant works. The interesting thing is, this is the poster. The poster sort of sells it almost as like a Peter Sellers comedy. It says here, you know, hilarious, one of the best films of the year, Sharps, but, you know, like, Matt Damon is on fire. That sounds like a bad thing, doesn't it? And it also invites a very cheap joke, which I'm not going to make. The problem with The Informant is it is not Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. It is, in the end, a film about somebody who is unreliable and, worse, not that interesting.
David Dunn points out that Lon Chaney Jr. played a Wolfman and Frankenstein's monster and Dracula in the various monster movies. Our movie of the week is...
Well, I would say it's A Serious Man, but I still want to go... New Moon! Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live